for Kevin, and as Kevin's already said, tonight we're looking at Nehemiah chapter 2. So if you follow Robert Murray McShane's reading plan, then either you've been here already, you're using tonight to take you through one of the four chapters, or you've still got it to come again, so whatever applies. But it's interesting, I don't know how often McShane's plan lands on the subject for the night, but there we go. Tonight it's Nehemiah chapter 2 we're going to consider. However, what I'm going to do is read a little bit of chapter 1, not in any way to repeat what William was teaching last week, but just to put some context so that we get the historical flow, if you like. So we'll read chapter 1, verse 1, the words of Nehemiah the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Susa the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are destroyed by fire. Verse 11, which is partway through, towards the end really of the prayer of Nehemiah. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name, and give success to your servant today, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. Now I was cupbearer to the king. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence, and the king said to me, why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Then the king said to me, what are you requesting? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favour in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river, and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So I went to Jerusalem and was there for 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night, by the valley gate, to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down, and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and entered by the valley gate, and so returned. And the officials didn't know where I had gone or what I was doing. And I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, oh, what is this thing that you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Then I replied to them, the God of heaven will make us prosper. And we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. And the Lord will bless this reading from his word. Now, the overview I've got of what we're looking at tonight divides chapter 2 into various sections. I've thought of the aspect of this being Nehemiah obtaining his formal commission from the king, and of course his commission from God. And the first 8 verses really, we'll look at in detail, but these really deal with Nehemiah obtaining the commission to go and do this work from the king. And then the next part, Nehemiah is inspecting where the work will take place, not the work itself, but the workplace, the workspace. Then he kicks off the work. And like so many other times in the history of Ezra and Nehemiah, he has to deal with opposition. So these are the sections that we'll look at. But I thought it was important to set some context. Now, I don't know how well that reads up there. I've got the benefit of something a bit closer to me to read. But it's worth looking at some timelines here, because they are significant, I think, to set some context and to see what it was that Nehemiah was up against. The Jews were taken into captivity in 586 BC under the Babylonians. And we read about that in 2 Chronicles, at the very end of 2 Chronicles. It's interesting, if you look, 2 Chronicles, the last 2 verses are identical to the first couple of verses in Ezra. Right, so 2 Chronicles ends exactly the way that Ezra begins, word for word. And in that sense, the last unique verses in 2 Chronicles are talking about Jeremiah's prophecy for 70 years and how the land will fulfill its Sabbaths. And this is going back to the misuse of the land in the kings that had been before. And there would be 70 years before the land was usable again, and before the people would be restored. And we'll come shortly to where that takes us to. But during the reign of Cyrus, Zerubbabel returned to build the temple. That's in Ezra chapter 2. And then in the reign of Darius in 516 BC, I think I said Darius the first time I met Cyrus, but Darius in 516 BC, we read in Ezra 6 when we were dealing with it, how the temple was rededicated. And that was the 70 years that Jeremiah had prophesied, and that 2 Chronicles tells us of, from the captivity to the temple being dedicated. And of course, that was the work that Ezra had gone to follow up on. The work that Zerubbabel did was to rebuild the temple. The work that Ezra really was there to do, as we see, was to teach the people. But the reason I'm picking in these things is that in Ezra chapter 4, there's a little parenthetic part. I don't know if you remember, as we looked at Ezra 4, there's this kind of awkward, how do you make sense of the history? And if you stick a couple of parentheses in, then it suddenly makes sense between verse 6 and verse 23. And Ezra tells us of letters that were written to the kings, to the different kings. So to Ahasuerus, he was the king who Esther knew and ended up becoming the queen to. The first letter was sent by adversaries who were named to protest about what's happening in Jerusalem. And then Artaxerxes takes over from Ahasuerus in 465, and a second letter was sent by another group of people. In 457, Artaxerxes sent Ezra to Jerusalem so he could teach the people. And then again, sometime before 445 BC, there's no date on it, but maybe not too long before 445 BC, a third letter was sent by various adversaries. And it's spelled out in detail in Ezra chapter 4. And the response from Artaxerxes was that work is to cease until a decree is made by me. And the work stopped at that point. And the work stopped on the building in Jerusalem. But Artaxerxes had said, until a decree is made by me. Now, well, that's the historical part. And then to think about the immediate timeline, that's a bit easier to read because it's bigger. This event that we've read about in Nehemiah, chapter 1 is in 444 BC, and chapter 2 is 445 BC, which is why I'm signifying pre-445. Ezra 4, remember I said, deals with this third letter, and the response from Artaxerxes is that work is to cease until a decree is made by me. Now that is interesting. You remember that when Daniel ended up being taken and thrown to the lions, the great problem was that the law of the Medes and the Persians could not be reversed. And what the king had said had been said. And the king couldn't change a law that he had made. In this case, Artaxerxes, God used him in this remarkable way to say, tell them to stop the work until you hear otherwise from me. Now, it's a subtlety, but it allowed later what happened that we read about in Nehemiah 2 to take place. And it just shows the great sovereignty of God at work in the heart and in the mind of a king who didn't know God, knew of God. He knew who God was, who Jehovah was, but he was not someone who worshipped God. He had his own gods that he worshipped. False gods, of course. But here was God working in this man and preparing the time. Now, of course, Nehemiah was conscious of this letter that had gone from Artaxerxes that had said, no more work to be done in Jerusalem. And that's important to remember. And what we read in Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1, it dates back to 445 BC. The month is Chislev, which is November, December. As a little aside, the Hebrew calendar is lunar, so it follows the moon. But unlike the Islamic calendar, which follows the moon, and the months just drift through the year, and each month falls on a different time of the year, the Jews had adjustments that they made so that the times of the year at which each month took place were the same. So what was a lunar calendar? It was an adjusted lunar calendar to coincide with the solar year. Otherwise, the festivals, the feasts that took place, wouldn't have been able to have taken place at the time of harvest every year in the same month, would they? Because they would have drifted. It just shows how, it's almost a silly word to use, how clever God is, but you see what I mean. In his people's calendars, they were far more sophisticated than those that were around them in how they did things. So anyway, Nehemiah hears this message that we read about in chapter 1, and hears that the walls are broken down and the gates are destroyed by fire. Now that phrase, if you notice, was repeated twice in chapter 2. And this really hit home to Nehemiah, and we didn't read, but he had heard these words, he sat down and wept, and he mourned for days and fasted. And of course William dealt with that very well last week when he was talking about Nehemiah and his fasting and his mourning and then his praying. But the tail end part of chapter 1 really I read because it feeds into chapter 2 before us. Nehemiah's prayer, now whether this was a prayer he made every day, whether this is a non-literal prayer but it's the sense of his prayer and it culminated with the end point on the day we read of in Nehemiah 2, isn't really desperately important. The essence of Nehemiah's prayer, he sums up by supplicating God, verse 11, and pleading with God, he says, O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name, and give success to your servant today, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man of course being the king. So the big push in his prayer was that he would have success today, having mercy in the sight of the king. And he had prayed that prayer for months, and he had prepared his heart. Now, he prepared more than that, as we'll see shortly. But that was how his heart was prepared. And then we read that in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, and that then takes us into sort of March-April time in 444 BC. This particular day that we read about in verses 1 to 8 occurs. And we read this fantastic section in Nehemiah 2. And the outcome was that Nehemiah was sent by Artaxerxes with a new decree. So the king prepared new papers. And what Nehemiah did was endorsed, supported, and commended by Artaxerxes. And his purpose was to rebuild the city. Zerubbabel had been sent to build the temple. Ezra had been sent to teach the people. And Nehemiah was sent to rebuild the city, including the walls of Jerusalem. And Daniel in chapter 9 had prophesied that that would take place. And if you read Daniel chapter 9, verses 25, 26, then you'll see that Daniel, who had of course lived before this, he prophesied that this would take place, that there would be a command would be issued. And this was the beginning of what we know as Daniel's 70 weeks. And without going into starting to analyse Daniel, because that would definitely be a sidetrack, as you may know from study, Daniel's 70 weeks was built, split into three parts, but two principal parts, 69 weeks and then a further week. And of course, these weeks are really sevens, and they're sevens of years, and they're periods of 7 years. And the first 69 are separate from the last one. But the significant thing is that 69 times 7 is 483 years in total, and it's about 176,000 days. And if you look at the date that Nehemiah gives, and just as an aside, although it doesn't give the fact that it was the first or the third day, the convention, apparently, is that when it says in the month of, and it doesn't give a number, that means it was the beginning of the month, the first day of the month, on the new moon. And 483 years after that, the Lord rode into Jerusalem on a donkey. He was presented as Daniel had prophesied to his people. Now that, you know, is something that many of us would know about anyway. But you know, something else struck me as I thought about that. Nehemiah had wept over Jerusalem. And as we read in Luke 19 of the Lord's entry, what is called the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, as he then led up to his death, he stopped and we read that he wept over Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, of course, would fall. But Nehemiah wept, and Jerusalem was to be rebuilt. His prayers were answered. So if we go on to think about how this took place, remind ourselves of what that overview was, and go on to the first section. When we read of Nehemiah praying that give success to your servant today, this day came, and it came in chapter 2 verse 1, and Nehemiah was sad in the king's presence, and that sadness wasn't really the thing to be in the presence of the King of Kings, the Emperor of Emperors, and so on. Apparently the rules of the court were that you looked happy when you were in the king's presence. But it's a great testimony to Nehemiah that when the king sees that he looks sad, the king asks kindly, The whole tone of the conversation between Artaxerxes and Nehemiah, you just do not get the impression that there's rebuke from Artaxerxes. "Why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick?" isn't an angry exchange. He says, "This is nothing but sadness of the heart." One gets the impression it's said with feeling. "Are you depressed, Nehemiah?" Whatever language you would have used, sadness of heart, we would maybe say, "Are you depressed? Are you feeling down? What's bugging you?" And the impression is that the king wasn't used to seeing Nehemiah this way. This man that he trusted as his cupbearer, and in a sense trusted with his life, as well as being in the privileged position of being an advisor, it was out of character for him to be sad. But nonetheless, Nehemiah was afraid. But the amazing thing is that he starts to speak to the king in this very courteous way. And his words in the conversation, the words of Nehemiah are much more verbose almost. The sort of eloquent words, whereas the king is very to the point. And that's the way conversations would go between a king and one of his servants. So there's nothing to be read into the way they spoke to one another other than that it was appropriate. But Nehemiah had prayed that he would find favour with the king. And when the king asked him why he was sad, well, he seized his opportunity. He was prepared. And he said, "Well, why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" And there we go. He quotes this phrase that we'd read in chapter 1. He doesn't mention Jerusalem. He shows a great deal of sensitivity in how he approaches things with the king. Nehemiah knew that this king had issued a decree against Jerusalem because he had been persuaded that Jerusalem was a problem for him, and that if he allowed Jerusalem to be rebuilt, it would be a disaster. And Nehemiah approaches the situation wisely. And he appeals to the fact that it was the place of his father's graves. His ancestors were buried there. And he strikes a chord with Artaxerxes and allows a conversation to develop. And lo and behold, Artaxerxes says, "What are you asking for? What is it you want?" And then we read these beautiful words at the end of verse 4 and the beginning of verse 5. "So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king." And we don't read what Nehemiah prayed. And I don't think it makes sense to think of it being a prayer that could be written out in words. This was a flash of his mind. I would suggest that what happened was Nehemiah said, "Lord, this is what I've asked for, help me." But he probably didn't even get as far as thinking out the words. You know what it's like? Something happens and something comes into a situation in your life and your brain moves at a fantastic speed compared with the speed your mouth can move. And I don't think for a minute that Nehemiah stood there in the presence of the king, bowed his head, closed his eyes, and uttered a prayer that took him the time it took. He knew that God would understand his thoughts. But the key thing is, he did pray to God before he spoke to the king. He was a man who prayed a lot. We saw that last week. But he prays to God for the help that he's been praying for months, and the strength to stand there before God, before the king, and tell him what God had laid in his heart. And we read, "And I said to the king, if it pleases the king and your servant has found favour in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." He didn't mince his words. There was nothing airy-fairy. He made it clear that the city was in ruins and he wanted to go and rebuild it. And he presented it in a way that didn't offend the king by reminding him that this was the Jerusalem that wasn't to be rebuilt without a further decree. But Artaxerxes trusted Nehemiah, I suggest. Now, of course, God was working in Artaxerxes, but I suggest he trusted him. And then he asked, "How long have you been gone for?" Well, we don't hear the answer. We read later on in the last chapter that he was away for 12 years and he went back. I don't think he told the king that he was going to be away for 12 years. Probably wouldn't have been granted leave of absence for 12 years. And I don't think it took him 12 years to go back. He probably went back at some other point. But he gave an answer. And then he says to the king, "If it pleases you, can I have some letters to give to the governors of the province beyond the river? And can I also have a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, and get timbers to make beams for the gates of the fortress, for the wall of the city, and for the house that I'll occupy?" Nehemiah had a plan. He had a strategic plan. When Artaxerxes said, "How long will we be away for?" he didn't say, "Here it goes." Sometimes wish some of my project managers would answer a bit more clearly like Nehemiah did, then, "Well, it just depends." He knew what he was going to do. Now, I don't think for one minute that suddenly the words come out of Nehemiah's mouth and somewhere in his brain he was thinking, "Oh, the answer's 12 weeks or 3 months or 10 years. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, I know what to say next. Oh, I'll ask for some letters." I think in the 4 months, Nehemiah had planned. And he was prepared. And when he was asking God to be ready when the opportunity arose that he might find favour with Artaxerxes, it was to put in place the plan that would allow the walls to be rebuilt. We need to be careful not to just leave everything to the moving of the Spirit as an excuse for not preparing ourselves. Nehemiah was prepared. He planned. He didn't just turn up in the day and, if I can use the phrase and you'll understand what I mean, get lucky. He had prepared himself for months. And even before the first incident we read about, I'm sure this man Nehemiah was somebody who cared and wanted to be used by God in his service. And the remarkable thing is that we read at the end of verse 8, "And the king granted me what I asked." He got everything he asked for from the most powerful man in the world, and probably the most, in terms of the build-up of powers of empires, probably the most powerful man that had ever lived up to that point. And he gave Nehemiah what he asked for. And he gave him a piece of paper that said, in effect, "I know what I said a few years ago. This is a new decree. Nehemiah has a job to do to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And this decree supersedes the cessation order that I issued X years ago. Don't stand in his way. Help him in whatever way you can." But of course, Nehemiah understood how all this had come about. Nehemiah writes, and of course, this is an autobiography. I read somebody describing it as Nehemiah's memoirs. That was a good way of describing it. "The king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me." Nehemiah understood that this was God who was at work in this remarkable way to bring this thing to bear. And up he got, and he went. And when he got to Jerusalem, he rested when he arrived. And he prepared himself. He didn't just dive in. You know, with 2 feet, we make a mess of things. He also discreetly inspected the city. And he did it by night, because he wanted to understand and assess the facts of the situation. He was preparing to lead the people. And again, he didn't just jump in there and say, "Hey, I've arrived. Look at this bit of paper." Maybe what some of us would do. You turn up, "I've got a new job. I'm the boss now. Right, we're going to start doing," and the first thing the person says is, "Do you know about the mess the sheep gate's in? Do you know about the mess that the dung gate's in?" "What are you talking about? What dung gate?" But Nehemiah, he got there on the ground and he prepared himself. And he prepared himself so that he could kick off the work. He had a kick-off meeting. Now, I say this reverently. I tell you, if Nehemiah's CV appeared to my desk, I don't think I need to interview him. The man was an exceptionally good organizer, planner, and leader. And it's quite remarkable to see how God used him. And the transformation there was. And you remember going back to the slides at the beginning in this long, slow process of the rebuilding and all of the opposition and all of the halts and the 100-something years gone past. And not a lot has happened in terms of the city. It's still not rebuilt. The walls are broken down. The gates are burned. And Nehemiah takes time to just assess the situation. And then he goes and he kicks off the work. And verses 17 to 20, it's interesting, it's the things he says and the way he says them. And there are lessons that we can all take when we think of leading the people of God. Now, I'm not just talking about elders. You could be a leader in a Monday club, responsible for leading the Monday club. You could be a leader on a Thursday night at Exchange, leading the work that's there. You could be the leader at the over 50s, whatever, in our contexts. It does, of course, apply to elders as well. But in this role of leadership, what was it he did? Well, he said to them, "You see the trouble we are in." The prepositions are good. "How Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision." You see the mess that we are in. There was no sense in which Nehemiah turned up and said, "Well, you've left this place in a bit of a mess. You see the mess that you are in," or any other such terminology. And neither did he say, "I'm going to sort this." He said, "Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision." And of course, this idea of suffering derision and being insulted and so on is a constant theme, and that was really what I was wanting to get across by looking at this history and all these letters in Ezra 4 and constantly all of these people. And we'd read, of course, in verse 10 that Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard that Nehemiah was coming. It displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. There was going to be derision, and we'll come to that in due course towards the end. And then he says, I told them. Oops, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. And I told them. And what he told them about was not that he'd a bit of paper in his pocket that came from the king, from the emperor in Persia. What he told them was the hand of God. Told them of was of the hand of God that had been upon him for good. And also of the words that the king had spoken to me. He got the order right. Nehemiah was emphasizing to the people that God was at work. And God was going to allow the walls to be rebuilt so that the city could be protected and so that he would have a place where his name was honoured and feared once again. The walls were knocked down, the gates were burned. Anybody could overthrow the place. In fact, overthrowing would be a bit of an unnecessary thing. You just walked in if you were an enemy. But the message from Nehemiah is that he'd been commissioned by God. The commission that he had from the king wasn't really for the benefit of his people, other than to give them reassurance of the king's support. The commission that he had on the bit of paper in his pocket was for the Sanballats and the Tobias and the Geshems of this world. And we'll see how he dealt with that even. And the remarkable thing is the response of the people. They said, let us rise up and build. God's purpose was that the people would rise up and build. God's purpose was not that Nehemiah would come along and he'd bring with him a squad of builders that were from Susa in the palace, or from anywhere else, and they'd come in as external labourers, contractors brought in. That wasn't what it was. What was the matter was that the place would be rebuilt by the people of God. And when Nehemiah spoke to them and told them it was God's plan, it was they who said, let us rise up and build. And they strengthened their hands for the good work. But as I've alluded to, there was opposition. And Nehemiah dealt with that opposition. And he dealt with it forcefully, bluntly. He stood up to these men. It's interesting how they started to jeer and despise, and yet Nehemiah had said to the people, let's rebuild the wall so that we no longer suffer derision. And as soon as he started, the derision came. It's interesting, these people, of course, the empire was well established and there were lots of records being kept. And these people are mentioned in records outside of Scripture. And they're governors. They're not just somebody who happened to have a house in a village just outside Jerusalem, and they sort of came along and were laughing at the people. These were powerful men. And in particular, this Geshem, the Arab, that's added, he was some real serious chieftain. And he had a massive area. And when you look at the areas that these people controlled, then they hemmed in Jerusalem. Hemmed in Judah, they hemmed in Jerusalem physically. They were surrounded by the places that these men ruled. And they came along, they jeered, they despised them, and said, what's this thing that you're doing? You can hear the sarcasm in the voice. And then the subtlety, are you rebelling against the king? Now, Nehemiah could have gone to his pocket and pulled out the bit of paper and said, well, no, actually. But Nehemiah dealt with the problem from first principles. Because the interesting thing is that if he hadn't explained that it was God's hand. He could never have said what he said at the end, which was a real damning indictment for these men. So he stood up to them and he said, in effect, I'm depending on God. It's the God of heaven, the God of heaven, as opposed to these gods of stone that you worship. This is the God. You've heard about him because you've been constantly mocking him for years. All of that is implicit in what Nehemiah had to say. The God of heaven will make us prosper. What confidence he had. God had told him that's what would happen. And he had faith and he believed God. Even as he stood in the presence of probably the three most important men for hundreds of miles around in any direction. And he said, God will make us prosper. And we, his servants, will arise and build. Now, I'm always reluctant, I don't know about you, I'm always reluctant to, I even find myself with work emails being cautious about using words like will and shall. Because there are so many things that we can say, I will see you on Monday, and things happen between now and Monday. And maybe as we're speaking to one another, we might say, all being well, Lord willing, or whatever. And whether it's said or what, the thought is there that as we plan forward, there are things we say we will do, but we know, and we've got the good sense to know, that God's will might be different between then and now. That wasn't necessary for Nehemiah. Nehemiah didn't say, and if he wills. See, Daniel's friends, when they were being thrown into the furnace, they said, our God is able. He can pluck us out of a fire if he wants to. And if he doesn't want to, well, so be it. Nehemiah knew because God had told him what he wanted him to do. Nehemiah had been commissioned by God. And when God had given Nehemiah this great commission that he had given to him, Nehemiah knew that he was going to succeed. And he says, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. No portion, no right, no claim. Now, one of the commentators, and I can't remember which, suggested that this was a legal mantra, really. And you can understand that. No portion, nothing from the past that they could say was their portion. Now, of course, the people of Israel, the portion in the land is a massive thing. And Nehemiah says to them, you have no portion in this place. Nothing here belongs to you. You have no right in this place. There is nothing currently that you have the rights over. No rights, no liens, nothing. And he's talking to the most powerful men, as I said, for hundreds of miles around. Nor, he says, looking to the future, do you have any claims that you'll be able to make here. There's nothing that you'll be able to claim in Jerusalem. Past, present, future, legally you're blocked out of this place. Now, these men were no fools, although the term Tobiah the Ammonite servant is used. The suggestion is that Nehemiah, as he wrote these memoirs, enjoyed writing about Tobiah in this way because he was the servant of the king. So Nehemiah chose to describe him as the servant. And these men, they wheedled their way into the Jewish families. One of their sons one of the grandsons was the son-in-law of Eliashab, the high priest, or I might have got the generations wrong there, I didn't make a note. But they were marrying into the families and doing all sorts of things to just get in the way and mess things up. But this strong declaration, and there's a strong message for us there, isn't there, on how to deal with opposition and how to deal with anything that's against God's will. Don't compromise. That was a lot of what Ezra was dealing with. And of course, it was happening, and Eliashib's family and Tobiah's family were interrelated. Which of course, was the intermarrying problem that Ezra had to deal with. But Nehemiah sets the scene and brings a message that's from God and tells these people, there's nothing for you here. And your attempts to interfere will serve no good. What a remarkable confidence he had. And that's because he was commissioned by God and he knew what he was doing. And just into the first verse of chapter 3, Eliashab the high priest rose up with his brothers the priests, and they built the sheep gate. And then we skip on to chapter 6, verse 15, and we read, the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. What a timeline compared with the timeline we looked at the beginning. God moved, and something amazing happened. God had decided the time had come. But the lesson for us, as we look at Nehemiah, and there are so many lessons in Nehemiah, as we'll see, of his character and the type of man he was, what a fantastic leader he was. But Nehemiah had prepared himself to serve God when the time came. And when the time came, he didn't stumble and fall. He immediately reacted to the opportunity. And he took it. And he was sent by the king. Took him a little time to get there. Took 3 days to assess the situation. Commissioned the work to start, and just over 7 weeks later, the job was finished. God enables things to happen, and God wills that things will happen, but he does expect his people to serve their part in it. And that's the great lesson to me of this particular part of Nehemiah. Nehemiah knew what God wanted done. He knew strategically what it was, and he put together a plan. He prayed about it, and when God gave him the opportunity, he took it. He engaged with the people, and he stood up to the opposition. And the work began, and God saw it through, and they rejoiced, as we'll discover when we get to the chapter, that they had managed to achieve this work in so short a time. What a fantastic commission Nehemiah was given. And we will see that between chapter 3 and chapter 6, there's plenty more opposition. It's not that just they did it in 52 days because nobody bothered them. But he was robust, and he knew what God's will was, because he prayed and prayed, and God had revealed it to him, and he served God. What a challenge that is to each one of us. What a challenge to us as we think about that moment when the king said, why do you look so sad? What are you wanting? We sometimes talk about having opportunities and we don't take them. Now clearly God would have other plans or other possibilities, but Nehemiah was there and he took the opportunity. And that's a challenge to each one of us as we live our lives day to day. Do we take the opportunities? Because when we do, and we commit ourselves to him, then remarkable things happen. So shall we pray? Our Father, we give thanks for thy word that teaches us lessons that apply down through the centuries, so much further down. And we give thanks to thee that we can look at this man, Nehemiah, who was just a man the same as we are. And it would be easy to say, oh, I couldn't do a thing like that or whatever. But Father, perhaps if we'd met Nehemiah, we might have been surprised at how nervous he was and the fear that he had when the king asked them about his countenance. Father, we do pray that day by day in our lives we may not fail to serve thee because of our fear. And we would ask that we might be bold and we might be prepared and we might be able to interact well with others so that they know what we stand for. And also with fellow believers so that we are supportive and can encourage one another to perform great works for thee. So we ask thy blessing. In the name of Lord Jesus, as we part. Amen.